Hey, welcome to If You've Come This Far, the podcast where Sean and I spend time with and have conversations with people who are trying to live meaningful, impactful lives, trying to make the world better while they're here. And this week on the show, we had Bob McKinnon, who is, I don't know, we did the math. I think we've had a handful of children's book authors, and Bob is one of those. Sean, tell us a little bit more about Bob.
I think children's book authors is perfect for us because that's about the level of our reading level, children's books. Well, Bob,
can I get those on audiobook? It would be helpful if I could just listen to them.
Well, and Bob's from Massachusetts, which is outside of Boston, which is a beautiful thing. All of a sudden, I'm reading Bob McKinnon's Substack. I'm not really sure how he got there. I love it. Great writer. Writes a lot about his family. One word titles for each post, which I don't know. Weirdly, I kind of dig that simplicity. And a few weeks ago, he's writing about his new book that's coming out, America's Dreaming. And he talks about how he collaborated with John Hsu on some aspect of it.
Right.
And if listeners recall, we interviewed John Hsu, who is one of our three children book writers who wrote Louder Than Hunger. And so I sent Bob a note. I said, you know what? Hey, we interviewed John on our podcast. Here's a link to it. He listened to it and asked if he could come and hang out with us. And what a great conversation. Just a smart guy trying to do. We talk about how much, I mean, this guy does a shitload of stuff. And so it was exciting to kind of go through that and meet another new person trying to do good stuff in the world. He never really revealed he is a soccer coach for his three daughters. He never did reveal their records though. So we'll have to get back on.
That's what the listeners want to know.
Well, I wanted to know. It's all about development, right? It's not about wins and losses. It's all about development for the kids.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because I mean, that's Bob's career/vocation is largely built around economic mobility. His first book, by the way, was a new twist on The Little Engine That Could.
Yep.
I'm going to space. I think it was called The Three Little Engines.
Three Little Engines.
Which is a neat sort of mindset shift for kids who read that book, right? They're all capable with help. And he does this thing called the Moving Up, I think, lab. This is the way he's committed to impacting the world.
Just, you know, a guy who's interested in other people and making sure that others get a chance. It's just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed him. And as so many of these guests, as it happens with so many of these guests, we're like, okay, well, we have to work with Bob somehow. Like,
right,
we're pulling in the same direction.
Yeah, it's funny when we say that and people look at us, oh, yeah, we'd love to work.
You think they're just humoring us?
Oh,
they're like, I can't get off this call fast enough. Are you kidding me? No, that's not true.
Not true.
Yeah. All right, let's hear from Bob.
All right, here we go.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing swell. Thanks.
Thanks for joining
us. Happy Friday.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Where are you guys located?
I am 26 miles west of Chicago. In Glen Ellyn, Illinois.
And I am in Chicago proper. I'm a city boy. I'm not really a city boy. We were just talking about where you are, which are you in Boston? Are you in New York?
I'm just outside New York in a town called Hastings-on-Hudson. Okay. But I grew up in Boston.
Mm-hmm. That's what it was. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you can tell by listening to Sean that he grew up in Boston too.
No. He can't tell that. He can't tell that yet.
Of course he can tell.
I've said five words. So, no, he can't.
He'll soon tell.
Well, it's interesting. I grew up in Boston, but then when I was 12, my mom moved us to rural Pennsylvania. So I went from a place where, you know, the letter R is pretty rare to a place where they thought every word should have three or four of them.
Right. Mine was when I moved, because I grew up at Lowell Chelmsford, so it's Northern Mass.
And then where was it?
Lowell, like Lowell.
Lowell, yeah.
Yeah. And And then I, when I was 22, I moved to Chicago, and then I went to Indy for a couple of years. In Indianapolis, they thought I was an alien. It's like, what is this?
But
yeah.
So I made a pilgrimage to Lowell once to go to the former home of Jack Kerouac when I was going through a beat phase.
Yeah. Oh, nice, nice. I feel like we need to get this out of the way. I was just having a good time with Sean before you got on, Bob, about I grew up a Celtics fan, but the Celtics got blasted. Was it last night or two nights ago? And so the Bruins in the same night.
It's back to back nights. It was highs and lows because they'd previously crushed their opponents and then they got their ass kicked. It's discouraging.
Are you still a loyal Boston fan of all, including the Patriots, or what's your jam?
For sure, yeah, tried and true on all of it. But what's interesting is that I am when I was just thinking about this morning because I'm like, you know, the way the schedule is, there's like a Bruins or a Celtics playoff game to watch like almost every night, which is quite the time suck. And when they lose, you feel really bad. Like that was not a good use of my time. And I was like, yet on the other hand, had they not even made the playoffs or gotten eliminated the first round, I would have been way over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to me, I don't know if guys feel the same way, but you know, growing up in Boston during sort of like the dark ages of like Red Sox, Yankees, and no one winning anything except for the Bird Celtics for a period of time, you were always just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so the fear of losing was always so much greater than the joy you would get with the victory.
Oh yeah.
And and even like all these championships later, I still carry that with me, you know?
I mean, we did kind of have the Celtics for the most part growing up in the 70s. I mean, we had,
then you had Len Bias and Reggie Lewis.
Oh,
and,
you
know,
man.
It's like, you know, can't we have nice things?
So my son is 23 and he grew up here he was born here in Chicago and, but I, you know, bred him as a Boston fan and he's sick fan. But in his lifetime, right. You talk about our lifetime, his lifetime, 13 championships.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Insane.
And we actually went to the Brady roast in LA.
Oh, jeez.
On Sunday. I mean, we have another place in Palm Springs. And so he came in and we drove up for that. It was quite.
I've only seen excerpts, but it was, I don't know. The psychology of that I find fascinating. I mean, I get it. You know, have your friends come and take a piss out of you. And I've been roasted before, so it's, you know, can be fun, although it can be cruel.
Yeah.
But there's so much sensitivity there, like about his wife, about the relationships and stuff like that. It's just like, man, you gotta be, you know, you're asking for it. And the blowback has been, you know, predictable.
Yeah. Well, and I think he was a co-producer on it too. So he was okay, I'm willing to take it.
Mint. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So Bob, thanks for coming. And just for the listeners, how we got together, I have been subscribing to Bob's blog, Moving Up Mondays, or
Moving
Up Mondays for a while. And sometimes I do a weekly newsletter and sometimes I link to what you do. Like Savor was a really good one. I like that a lot. Recently linked to that. But you had one called Reveal, which you talk about John Hsu, and with your new book coming out. And Chris and I had interviewed John just a little while ago about his new book. And so I commented on that. You listened and reached out and said, hey, would love to come talk to you guys. And we're thankful because now you are the third, I think the third, male children's book author that we've had on the show out of like 50. So I'm not sure what that says about our ratio, but we're glad you're here.
And thanks for having me. And yeah, it just shows you the sort of the serendipity of things, right? How things are sort of connected and, you know, linked and whatnot.
Yeah.
And for the record, we don't interview just any old children's book author, only the very best.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. So Bob, there's so many places that we could go to start with you. So many things.
Because you do so many things.
Yeah. And we want to get into all of it, but maybe we want to offer you the opportunity to start where you want to start.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess maybe I would just start with like a quick sort of through line to all the work. Right. And so after, you know, a fairly successful career, you know, when I, sorry, like, let me go back one step. When I grew up outside of Boston, I grew up in Chelsea, right? Which then, and still to some extent now, was just a place that there wasn't a lot of opportunities, right? And my mom was a bartender. She raised three kids on her own, you know, dealt with a lot of different issues growing up. And so my initial definition of the American dream was classic, right? I just wanted to do better. I wanted to get out. I wanted to make more money. I wanted to do nice things for my family. And I was fortunate to do a lot of those things. And then there was just sort of this lack of meaning that I was finding in a lot of my work. And I wanted to try to find ways to not just make a difference, but sort of crack the code of like really trying to understand, like, you know, how do we end up where we do? You know, why do some people succeed? Why do others not? You know, in my own situation, I've had a different, you know, life trajectory and path than my brother and sister and friends and families that I grew up with. And so, and some of that came with a lot of guilt and imposter syndrome and a lot of that stuff. And so I've just been on this quest for, you know, maybe the last 15, 20 years of trying to not only just ask those questions for myself, but share that journey in different forms. And, you know, I never had any dreams or aspirations of being a kids author. That was all a series of events that I could tell you later about, but it just happened. And it was a good vehicle to sort of share stories about why some people make it and not, and how to sort of think about our journeys relative to others. And I didn't really think about like, man, I want to go do a podcast, but you know, I had some relationships and I was having these kinds of conversations with people about sort of the research around social mobility and such. And I was like, man, I would be great if I just recorded these. And so there was a podcast, right? Yep. The newsletter was just, you know, I've always loved to write. And I just wanted to say like, hey, let's see if I put this out there, if people find it of value. And so each step of the way, there've just been these projects that have popped up as different ways to express a very similar theme, right? Which is asking questions about how do we end up where we do? And in doing so, try to provide some help for others, much like I've been helped myself. And so, and that extends to the teaching I do at different colleges. And we just started a social mobility lab at City College, which I'm really psyched about. And so, yeah, it's a lot of different stuff, but it is, there is a little method to that madness.
Do you identify, this is a sort of an old school phrase maybe, but do you identify as a kid that got out, you know, like of from wherever they started?
You know, I used to, right? Because I used to sort of, you know, it's like a badge. It's like climbing the ladder and sort of other kinds of metaphors in terms of I made it out. But I got to be honest with you, when I was living in Chelsea, I loved it. You know what I mean? Like when you're, even though you didn't have a lot and there were a lot of issues that you didn't even know that were happening around you at the time, there was a lot to really just love, you know, in terms of the friends and the people and the environment and the sense of community. But I do now, looking back, recognize that there were just not a lot of opportunities afforded to me or kids like me at that time. Whereas now, living a completely different lifestyle, I see how advantage compounds. And so, you know, I don't know what the metaphor would be right now in terms of getting out or not. But, you know, it's interesting. Like there's been some studies from like Raj Chetty at Harvard that looks at sort of some certain neighborhoods that do better in terms of, you know, supporting social mobility. And when people first saw some of that research, because it was basically broken down to the zip code, right? One of the things that people said is people should just move. And I was like, it's not easy. It's not cool. You know? And so I was like, you know, but I've heard another sort of a phrase that I really like, which is, you know, we should be providing people the things they need to thrive in place. You know what I mean? Like you shouldn't have to like, you know, leave your neighborhood school to get a better education. Your neighborhood school should just give you a good education, you know, and have the resources it needs to do so.
Could you briefly go over the series of events that sort of got you out? Like, were you a hard charging high schooler who wanted to go to a great school and then moved far away, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, just to add to that, Bob, I mean, you referenced that, you know, your brother and your sister may have had different outcomes for them too. So, you know, maybe what were the differences between the three of you as you talk about this.
Yeah. So just for my first plan of getting out was to follow in the line of left fielders for the Red Sox. And so it was going to be, you know, Williams, Yaz, Rice, and McKinnon. And that didn't work out so well. So once that was apparent, then I sort of had to shift other.
What did you give up on that about two years ago or what?
Yeah, I'm still holding out hope, to be honest with you. You know, I'm still waiting for that Disney flick of the softball player who makes it to the big leagues. Anyway, so it's one of those things where like one of the first things to show you, you know, I'm sure you've maybe heard of the term flashbulb moments, these sort of memories, these stories about your own life that you repeat often or that had sort of an outsized effect. And in my life, I remember I wore glasses from the very early stage, and they were really bad because they were the only kinds of, you know, I think you got to pick from like two frames if you were, you know, on Medicaid. And so they were nasty glasses, but they had the benefit of maybe making me look smart. And so my mother began calling me her little professor. Mm. And she didn't know any professors, you know, so it was just this idea of like, that's what a smart person was. And even at the time, it's not like I was wearing glasses and reading Tolstoy, you know, I was reading box scores. And so, but it sort of cemented this idea and, you know, this is not a great thing, but I remember, you know, he's the smart one, which was a disservice to my siblings, right? Who were smart in different ways, and still are intelligent in certain areas of life that I can only dream of. And so, you know, one, there was a sort of self-reinforcement of like, oh, I'm supposed to get good grades and I'll sort of try and, you know, and I'm, you know, destined to sort of go to college. And that was sort of an expectation that was set very early. And then as I sort of moved on, I mean, there were teachers that were there to sort of help me through difficult transitions. I had this very sort of specific plan that college was the way, you know, quote, to get out, you know, that education was the great leveler. When that time came to sort of try to go to college, I was fortunate that Pell Grants were around. And in fact, you know, years ago, I did this thing in January where every day I posted something I was grateful for. And I posted this picture of Claiborne Pell, you know, the father of the Pell Grants. And he used to run in cut off business suits. I guess he was pretty frugal. But I remember posting that and online, and people were just coming out of the woodwork to be like, Claiborne Pell, thank you, Mr. Pell. I mean, he was long gone, but, you know, he was just sort of, you know, just, you know, these ideas that there are, you know, different kinds of programs or people that help us along the way that we sometimes don't remember or we don't recognize or we don't thank. And so actually a lot of this stuff in my own journey, I captured it in a TED talk I gave several years ago. But beyond that, I created a quiz called Your American Dream Score that asks a series of questions for you to reflect on your own life, right? And then you get a score of the things that were, you know, and a list of the things that were working for you and against you. And you know, the things that are working for me, I mean, I've always had good health. You know, you asked about my brother and sister. My sister is not. And so those were issues that she's had from a very young age. And I've always had a network of people who could help me in terms of, you know, whether that was some support in college or once I was out getting jobs and stuff like that. And so there were a myriad of different factors that were able to sort of help me along the way that maybe, you know, family members, others didn't benefit from. But I mean, first and foremost, it started with an education and this belief that that's what I was destined for.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to ask Bob if your mom is still around. Mm.
Yeah, she is.
Probably pretty proud of her little professor, huh?
Yes. And I'm equally proud of her. I mean, she gives back in so many ways that are sort of not recognized or won't make its way onto a podcast, but you know, she's a special person.
That's awesome.
So I took the test. What I found interesting is I took the test thinking about, do I have this right? Do I remember this condition particularly right or not? And I think, you know, I was thinking about the questions that there is a lot of that health support, right? Are those your life? You just kind of gave us some sense of it for what happened for you. As you study this, are those the things that you see that make a difference for others too? I mean, if you think about the social mobility lab that you're doing at CCNY, are those the things that you're honing in on? Is how do you get mentors and support and keep people healthy?
I mean, there's things that you can't control, right? So you don't control your parents, you don't control where you grow up. You know, there's certain things in life that this is where you're starting and this is what you have, right? And so we want to recognize and acknowledge, like, you know, some people are born with more advantages than others. And then once you go from there, it's like, all right, what kind of supports do you need to put in place to make sure that that those advantages don't get compounded, which is actually, there's a term for it, the Matthew effect, which is the idea that, like, once you, it's just the way in which money compounds, right? So does good fortune. And so how do you find ways to level the playing field? And so, and sometimes there's things that may seem obvious, like financial support, mentors, internships, you know, whatever. And then there are just sort of softer things, you know, that maybe we don't always, you know, give credit to. Like I was just mentioning before, sort of setting the expectation early that, you know, college is worth it for you. One of the things that came out of a recent study at City College, which itself is one of those schools that lives up to the promise of higher ed, which is an engine of economic mobility. They do a really wonderful job at that, although they're not always sure why, right? And so that's part of what we're trying to understand. But one of the things they had learned recently was that the simple act of knowing that graduating from college has a significant financial advantage results in people finishing their college education. I mean, it may seem intuitive to us, but we're also in an environment right now where people question the value of higher ed, you know, the elites, you know, things like that. Some of that sort of self-inflicted wounds of looking down on others who don't graduate from college. But but these things in terms of just setting expectations and the soft factors about how do we think about our own life. It was interesting when you said when you were reflecting on your own life, you weren't even sure, right? Like how did this, and I remember when I took, I sat and had my mom take the quiz and she's answering questions. And I'm like, Mom, that is patently false. I'm like, you did not have these advantages. And she's like, no, I did. And there is this sort of notion of how do we see our lives? Do we see it as a series of deficits, or can we also acknowledge that we have assets that are working for us? And then how do you leverage those assets?
Yep.
And so, that's what we're sort of trying to do, to sort of, you know, have people, it's not always just giving them the answers, but how do we constantly reflect on our own lives and the lives of others and then learn?
Well, and just before we leave it, Chris, because I know you have a question, I can see this dialogue that's going on about college and not college. And I get the data, but if we frame the not college, the people where that doesn't necessarily work for them in a different way, it's a different approach. It's a different outcome that where your life can be just as grand if we have a different attitude about it. True.
Yes. True. As long as we continue to support it. So here's an example. My brother works at Harley Davidson, right?
Yep.
And has been there for, 25, 30 years. And, you know, even though things have changed at Harley, he is still sort of set up to have lived a pretty good life. He loves motorcycles. He loves to work with his hands. He can take apart an engine and put it back together while I'm just looking to try to find out how to change my oil, right? And so, you know, and he was still in that occupation at a time with, because of, you know, benefits that the union had negotiated, that you could have a pension or a retirement fund and benefits that would get you, you know, through life. And so, you know, he's going to be okay. Yeah. But increasingly, those kinds of jobs are rare, right? And so it's a little bit more difficult than maybe it was, you know, 10, 20, certainly 50 years ago, where those kinds of jobs were the kind of path to a middle-class life that was great,
right?
Where you could, you know, support your family, go on a couple of vacations, you know, coach your kids' little league, all that kind of great stuff, right? I just think that those things are a little bit more difficult because of the way in which we fail to support certain kinds of occupations. But the dignity in that kind of work, I think, is something that we need to lift up more. There was a wonderful book I read many years ago called Breakfast at the Victory by, I think it was James Carse. And he talked about just watching, sitting there at a diner and watching the chef in the kitchen and just how the precision in terms of making so many different sort of meals at the same time. And it was just, he was just looking at it with wonder and awe, which we can when we look at certain jobs that maybe we don't always hold up because they didn't sort of come with some kind of advanced degree.
Bob, I work at an organization called New Schools Venture Fund. So we're an intermediary funder of education entrepreneurs. We've been around for like 25 years. It was started by a couple of legendary venture capitalists. And I had just been telling Sean that I'm headed out to San Francisco next week for the reboot of our annual big event. It's called the Summit.
Yep.
And it takes me back to, I think it was the first time I attended Summit, probably around 2012 or 13. And I remember Thomas Friedman from the New York Times coming and giving a talk. I don't know if he'd written a book. He had at least written an article about the prospective return on investment of college. And so you talk about us making opportunity available. One way I think we're not making it available is the cost of college, right? Because I don't think Friedman was arguing that you're not going to be better off if you don't go to college. He was arguing that the expense, the investment in it was, didn't make it worth the return. And now we're seeing a lot of higher ed institutions closing. So hopefully that consolidation maybe will help. But I just think it's important to, I mean, this is a huge investment decision for, probably it was probably a huge investment decision for your mom and you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so
when you
yes.
decided to pay.
Yeah. So great points. I mean, Paul Tough, who actually spoke at the launch of our social mobility lab, had recently written about this, and the research is coming in to be a little bit more clear, right? Mm-hmm. So whether college technically pays off, you know, strictly from a financial, you know, thing, which I'll get back to in a second, is dependent upon a couple of things. Did you finish in 4 years? You know, what is your degree? You know, what kind of job prospects do you have going on? So there is some sort of calculation, but generally speaking, if you graduate in 4 years from almost any university and you get a job in that given field, it's going to pay off for you, right? But I think that, you know, and then beyond that, there's also like, well, is the value of college strictly financial? You know, or are you also getting other kinds of benefits in terms of being able to see the world and think about the world in new and different ways? Mm-hmm. I mean, when college is done right, you know, sometimes I think that college, when it becomes sort of just a factory for different kinds of trade, it sort of loses some of its initial purpose. But, you know, I think that, you know, my fear is that sometimes this is it worth it or not? We hold up examples like Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs or whomever, right? Who went to a pretty good college, you know, for a year or so. And then in that short period of time had the resources and network to then sort of take what they had already sort of thought about or built or, and just sort of take off with it. Right. And so I think that that's the problem. I think sometimes we set it up in terms of like, look at those guys. I'm like, yeah, but there's a deeper part of that story that you don't have access to think that you could just go ahead and do it without getting some additional stuff. And to your point, when I went to college, it was, you know, it was obviously many years ago. It was much different. I was in Pennsylvania. I, you know, the simple cost of applying to college, which, you know, I think was $50 then, is $50 now, or maybe more. It was cost prohibitive. You know, I see people who, you know, they basically apply to 17 colleges, $50 a pop. I'm like, that's $1,000 just applying.
Right.
And so I applied to one college. I was fortunate enough to get in. It was a state college. At Penn State, and I got a great education there. And when I got out, I had some student loans, but the interest rates were reasonable because they were protected, and I paid it off. And you know, and so it was a struggle, but it was done. Now, however, if you are saddled with extraordinary amount of debt at interest rates that are just predatory, you know, then it sort of defies the sort of the intention, and you get into a lot of trouble.
Well, particularly your point about having kids stay in school. I mean, the kids that go for a couple of years and take on the debt and then don't graduate, and now they've got the debt and no degree, where they were on arguably they're worse off than when they started,
no doubt,
which is unfortunate.
Well, it's also not maybe that easy to graduate in 4 years if you're a kid who's also having to work two jobs, right? Like work at, you know, in the dining hall, cleaning dishes and doing something else, right?
Well, that's a great point. When I teach, so I teach at both Parsons School of Design and at City College, and those are two completely different kinds of student bodies, generally speaking. And so at City College, you know, most of the kids there are working, right? And have other responsibilities at home. And I start each class by checking in with them and asking, like, you know, in one word, how do you feel?
Yeah.
And they can't repeat another word, you know, from someone else. And so the number of synonyms for the word tired that I've heard, you know, are pretty remarkable, right? I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm very exhausted. and you hear these stories. And then what's challenging is that when they go to put their resume together, right? They don't have these fancy internships or things like that often, but they've got this other stuff where they've been working their ass off, holding multiple jobs, helping their family. And like the current sort of form and accreditation on a resume doesn't account for that, where maybe right. we should, because right. it's really showing someone who's dedicated and working hard.
Well, because if you showed me that additional data as a prospective employer, that's the kid I'm hiring, right?
Yeah.
I just want to make a quick note here that of the three children's book authors that we've interviewed, two of them are Penn State alumni.
That's true. That's wow. true.
That's funny. Who was the other?
Ben Feller. He was the chief White House correspondent for what, NBC or something?
No, Associated Press.
Associated Press.
That's funny. Yeah.
This episode of If You've Come This Far is brought to you by Judson & Moore, Chicago Distillers of American Whiskey. Right here in the Avondale neighborhood on the west bank of the Chicago River, our friends at Judson & Moore are distilling, barreling, bottling award-winning bourbon, rye, and single malt whiskeys. So if you like whiskey or great cocktails or great music, you should treat yourself by paying them a visit. You can learn more at judsonandmoore.com. And please consider following our show in the meantime.
And so you on June 4th, I think is the date, you have your next book coming out, American Dream. So I want two things. I want you to talk about, and this goes in line, I think, with our conversation thus far. Talk about the book, and do you still believe in the American Dream?
Yeah, so yes, I do still believe firmly in the American Dream. And the book, America's Dreaming, that's all good. So it was inspired by the story that I had that I shared earlier, which was this, I was a kid growing up in Boston, didn't have a whole lot. My mom, in a cliched way, meets a truck driver and decides to move us all down to Pennsylvania for a shot at a better life, right? And for a period of time, we moved from one kind of poverty to another. And so, when we first moved there, we were living in a motel, and then we were living in a trailer park, right? And so here I was, a kid in fifth grade, starting in a new school, looking and sounding different, and it was a rough transition. And I had a teacher by the name of Mr. Downs, who was just salt of the earth, just a great guy. And, he was just kind and made me feel welcomed. And years later, when, as I mentioned before, I was going through this period of thanking someone every day, I wanted to reach out and thank Mr. Downs. And when I did so, using the power of the internet, I found him. And what I found was his obituary, and he had died 2 weeks previously. Mm-hmm. So someone who I wanted to thank and hadn't really thought of, I didn't. And so in this book, essentially there's a character called America, and they show up and they're not welcomed. And the first line of the book is, have you ever felt all alone in a crowd? Mm-hmm. And it's this beautiful image of the student looking at a student body and feeling just very small. Mm-hmm. And there was a decision that was made at some point, which, I can share more about if you're interested, but that I decided we would never show America. So to write a children's book where you never see the main character, you only see it from their perspective, which means that America can be anyone. Mm-hmm. They could be someone who's moving from a different country, or like me, from a different town. They can be a white guy like me, or they can be a minority. They can be anyone. But we all, I think, would agree that every child in America deserves to feel like they belong here and that they're welcomed. And there's research that shows like every year, 5 million students will start in a new school, and that can just be intimidating. And when you were talking about this idea of, what contributes to sort of, success and whatnot, when a child does not feel welcomed in school, and that begins a cascading of effects, they can be sad or depressed. They choose to sit in the back of the class. And if they sit in the back of the class, they get called on less. If they get called on less, then they are less engaged in their learning, and so on and so on and so on. And so in America's Dreaming, America is welcomed by a teacher also named Mr. Downs, and then introduced to the power of books. And there's a welcome wagon in the classroom. And Mr. Downs introduces America to a collection of books that showcase other people in America's history, our country, who similarly did not feel welcomed or had issues. So Amelia Earhart moved around as a child a lot, had to start in all kinds of new places. And Sojourner Truth, you know her story, and Martin Luther King, and Emma Lazarus, you know, who wrote the poem at the Statue of Liberty. And it is a reminder that throughout our history, we have had people who moved and took chances and ultimately felt like they belonged. And by doing so, it made our country stronger. Mm-hmm. And it reminds us of an essential quality of our country. We generally, I don't want to make too broad a generalization, but we have not done a great job of making people feel welcome in this country as much as we should, because of the way they look or sound or where they come from or how they identify or whatnot. And they're still kids. And so that's the point of this book, is to try to make sure we remind ourselves that our goal is to make sure that any child, whether they're stepping into a school or a community, and who cares where they're coming from, that they feel like they belong and they welcome. Because when we do so, it's important to recognize their own human dignity, and it's good for their future, and it's good for the future of our country.
I have to make a plug here for some of my organization and some of my colleagues, people who are way smarter than me and brilliant educators in their own right. But they have framed kind of what you're talking about and named it an expanded definition of student success, right? So success in after school and in life is not just cognitive learning and a strong academic foundation. It's also this mindset and habits, but also what they call like the positive learning environment. So it's the sense of belonging. It's the sense of safety. Yeah. It's the sense of fairness and expectations. You talked about your mom, maybe raising your own self expectations. Yeah. So I think that people are increasingly being made aware of this. And I love the fact that you're out there, you know, writing books about the same notion.
It's one of those things where there wasn't a term for it for a long time, but we now hear the term imposter syndrome, like this idea that we don't feel like we're worthy of wherever we are. And it's something I've carried with me a long time. And, and it shows up in little ways. Like I remember, because even when I was trying to sort of, you know, better myself and, you know, read different things, I read a book, and then I told someone what the name of the book was. And I said, oh, I just read, you know, Remembrance of Time by Proust. And they're like, it's Proust. And I'm like, okay, so I'll never talk about a book I read again, because right. I don't want to feel that indignity, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
And so, you know, there are these ways in which to, you know, build that sort of confidence and that strength that we can feel mm-hmm. comfortable walking in any room and knowing that, like, hey, we're as good as anyone else here, and we have every right to be here as anyone else. And I think that is, going back to Sean, your question, I think that's an essential part of the American dream, right? And I think that because there are people, you know, it's easy to get sort of, you know, caught up in all of the tragedy and trauma in the world. But every day there are, you know, millions of teachers who are showing up and doing the work to try to make kids feel welcome, right? And in some ways, this book is a love letter to Mr. Downs and his memory and teachers like that, right, who are doing that. And there are people in communities who are similarly doing it, right? Mm-hmm. Just don't give them platforms the way we do, you know, others. So I think that's another thing that I want this to be a celebration and a remembrance of, you know, go out and thank that teacher who made you feel mm-hmm. welcome before, you know, in my case, it was too late, you know?
You talked about your gratitude for your mom and for Mr. Downs. Like, is this an ongoing, like this
yeah.
Sharing of gratitude? Is that something that's part of your life?
No doubt. So a couple things. After we did Your American Dream score, I should say that was created in conjunction and support with the Ford Foundation and with PBS. And so then the next thing we did was, I referenced that, a TEDx talk that I had given, which was said, how did I end up here? And in that, I created what I called like the worst PowerPoint slide ever, because it defied the logic of how many words you're supposed to have on it. And on that slide was a list of everyone I had to thank.
Mm.
Oh. And I went back generations in my family, because obviously if my grandparents aren't there, they didn't meet, I'm not here, and so on and so on, going back further and further. But then it was also recognizing people I had never met, like Claiborne Pell and, you know, and things along those lines. And I learned, like, for example, I learned to, you know, I learned to read and learn my numbers through Sesame Street. And so I wanted to know who, I wanted to thank Joan Cansgooney for doing that. Right. And so after that, we created, a small sort of like, you know, little app or piece of, you know, interactive, software where you could create your own dream team. It asks you a series of questions about sort of like, you know, your family, your friends, where you grew up, organizations that you participated in, things that you have done. And then at the end, you get this printed version of your dream team.
Hmm.
And so I try to carry that. And in fact, one of the things that I do on my podcast Attribution is that when the credits roll around, and you normally, you know, I'm sure you know the drill, you basically are thanking your producer or whoever did your music or whatever, sponsors. And I cede that time to my guest. And I say, I want you to take the credits and thank anyone you want.
Yeah.
And then that's been sometimes the richest part of those conversations, because they're thinking back and they're like, oh, you know, I haven't thought about this person in a while, and I just want to give a shout out. And I think saying those people's names is just so validating and self-reinforcing. And the more that we do that in the world, I think the better it is. So it's a, yeah. So it is something I try to do. Not always great, you know, like, look, you know, I have my share of frustrations with people and kids and stuff like that, but yeah, try to remember there's a lot to be grateful for.
So I'm three quick things. First of all, to this day, I'm 60 years old. I think about how I learned math from Sesame Street. I mean, it's weird. It's weird how it comes up. Secondly, watching all this basketball on streaming platform, there's an advertisement with Conan O'Brien, his new show, and he's talking to this guy, and he says, "Oh, the last tango in Paris." The guy goes, "No, it's the last tango in Paris." And Conan looks at him like, "You're such an asshole." So when you said the Proust thing, it's the immediate thing I thought of, like, oh, what an asshole.
Yeah.
Thirdly, when we talked with the other authors of children's books, and I really feel this way, having read a lot of what we'll call children's books, there's messages and lessons for everyone. And no, so no. I'm wondering, as you write them, we call them children's books. Are you hoping, or are you, is it part of your strategy that adults are picking up these books as well and reading them?
Yeah. Well, so two parts. One, you have to write it for the child, right? So if you don't, it feels like it's some sort of polemic that's going to go over a kid's head, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, they're the audience, but they're being read to. And so, and also parents or librarians or teachers, they want to sort of, you know, have books that are engaging for kids and fun, but also sort of can help reinforce the lessons and the values that they want to put out there. And so I am constantly doing that and trying to do it in a way that doesn't seem, you know, that tries to address common and shared values and doesn't seem overly, you know, polemic. And so an example of this is my first children's book was Three Little Engines. And so it was this retelling of the classic Little Engine That Could story. And that story tells a very important lesson, which is that you should believe in yourself. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, right? And yet if you read that book closely, you'll also notice that there are a lot of trains that are sort of like unhelpful, you know, or mean. Mm-hmm. And it also is this idea of like, well, those trains and other trains, they all have different journeys, right? And so, you know, how do any of us get over a mountain and get to the other side? And so I wanted to create a book that, one, acknowledged that, yes, of course, you have to sort of have your own effort. You know, I think I can. But that we do have our different journeys. And if someone is struggling and you made it over because you worked hard or you had some help, then you should look back and say, is there anything I can do to help them get over the mountain? And the answer to that is, I think we can. And so in that situation, there could be some readings of that, which is like, oh, you know, this is a liberal thing about, you know, trying to sort of say that it's not about hard work. And that's not the case. It is definitely about, you know, working hard and working for each other. And so I think that in a lot of the narratives we have, you know, whether for children or certainly for adults, there's always these sort of black and white kind of, you know, either or. And it seems strange because children's books are so short, but they actually can convey nuance in a way that I think is really helpful.
For sure.
And I think that, you know, that's the hope. The hope is whether you're a child or, you know, an adult reading it to them, that you are seeing the world a little differently. Like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I agree with that. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Different artist on this book than the first one?
Yeah.
The new one?
Yeah. So the first book was illustrated by a husband and wife pair. And, you know, they did a fantastic job. With the second book, we were looking for someone who's, you know, the illustrations are a little bit more dreamy. So there's a sort of style and there's a matching process that happens, you know, from the publisher trying to find someone who they think will bring the story to life. And then the illustrator herself, Tai Mei Huang, she can relate to the story, you know, because it's something that she can experience. And she, you know, when we put the press kit together, we did something that was, I think, a little unique. You know, I wrote a letter that was like, this is what the story means to me. And it includes some of the journey that I talked about earlier. And then she did the same. And she said that when she first read the book, she cried.
Mm.
And, you know, I just found that really sort of touching. And again, you know, in terms of what she was able to do to give an illustrator the challenge of writing or illustrating a book where you can't show the main character, but you still need to convey that main character's emotions and feelings.
Yeah.
She just did a masterful job in terms of perspective and choices in terms of what to illustrate and things along those lines. It was really fantastic.
I have to say, I love that decision to not show the main character, just show the perspective of the main character. I don't know if I've seen that before. Have I? Maybe.
I don't know. I'm sure it's probably been done once or twice, but I think it was one of the things that was trying to get out of a lot of the, how do I say this? A lot of the debate and division about who should tell a story or whose story something is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like, you know, I'm a white author, right? And to write a book where the main character was an immigrant who was changing schools or something like that, like, you know, is that appropriate or not? But the experience of starting a new school and not feeling welcome is universal.
Yeah.
And rather than trying to sort of peg that experience to any type of person or child, to basically try to show how universal this is by ironically not showing the character, I think was the clearest and simplest and hopefully most effective way to do so.
So you, in your blog, you sometimes write about your family, and I think you have three daughters. I'm not sure how old they are, but I'm curious if you engage them as editors or a focus group at all, as you're writing these books, do you get their feedback?
Yeah.
Or do they want to give you feedback?
Yeah. So a couple things. I'm trying to figure out how kind and generous I should be. Kids.
I recommend being very kind.
Cause Chris has two daughters. I have two daughters and a son. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. So I have three daughters, 12, 14, and 16. So when the first book came out, they were my first readers. So I was like, hey, kids, is this any good?
Yeah.
And they were all pretty supportive. And in fact, you know, had they said that it sucked, maybe I don't write it, you know, because, you know, or whatever. Because it was that was a complete whim. I mean, the inspiration for writing Three Little Engines was through this other work I was doing on social mobility. There was a professor who I knew who was doing work on this concept of headwinds and tailwinds, the way in which we sort of feel the support or the resistance in our life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his work, and he's a professor by the name of Shai Davide, who's not at Columbia, and he was featured in The New Yorker by the writer Maria Konnikova. And at the end of that article called America's Surprising Views on Inequality, she asked him what in his own life he does to reflect his research. And he said, I can tell you what I don't do is I don't read The Little Engine That Could to my kids. I've always hated that book because some engines can't. And I thought that was an interesting observation and a little harsh. And so that was like, oh, I wonder if there's a different way to tell that story.
Interesting.
And so I wrote it, you know, in a matter of a couple of hours over, you know, in a notebook by my bedside. And my chicken scratch can still see that version. And I read it to my kids. And again, had they been like, Dad, that's just dumb or whatever, because we had read the original and they liked it.
Yeah.
And so they were my first readers, certainly for that. I read the second one to them. They're a little older, a little less engaged. They don't, you know, the little ones, you know, let's little one, she's 12. She's like, she's like, oh, my dad's an author. He's famous. I am not. But it's, but like, there's at least interest there. Like, oh, you know, I've got my book, the box of books coming. I can open it and see it for the first time. And I remember when that first book came out, that box sat in our kitchen for like a week because we could not get the interest or everyone around from their own things. Can we open this and make a big thing? And it was like, no, we got soccer. Even now, like, so, I had learned this interesting term, in children's books called Easter eggs, where you hide things in the book to sort of like that not everyone will know. And so in America's Dreaming, there are three characters that are named after my children, and they don't look like my children, but they capture their personality. And so that I think they're really sort of, you know, interested in, and they're so, and they are supportive. They're great kids. But as it relates to the story, I do sort of, you know, share it with them, but they're now of the age where they're sort of aging out of, you know, who these are originally sort of designed for.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, you probably know that like the real goal of our podcast is to talk to people who are working to make a positive impact with their lives. Right.
Yeah.
So not surprisingly, many of them are doing so much, you know, and a few of them have been, I think I can speak for you too, Sean. We've been like, how in God's name are you holding all this shit down? I would say you're one of those people right now, especially now that we've learned that you've got two preteen three, you know, daughters between the age of 12 and 16. How are you doing this?
So it's, you know, I get the question a lot because it does seem like a lot. And it is, because in addition to those things I mentioned, I also consult with nonprofits and foundations to sort of help, you know, them in their work and help the people they serve. And I mentioned three daughters. I coach all three of their travel soccer teams, which is
travel.
Yeah. Which, jeez, you know, it's a pretty significant investment of time. But, you know, one, as I probably don't do any of them as well as I could, sort of like, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. So as you know, with a podcast, you could spend all day trying to figure out how to, like, you know, do it better, get it out there, have it discovered, et cetera. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm not able to go as deep as I probably would like, but in the doing of each of those things, I really enjoy, you know, I love talking to people. Yeah. I love writing. I love, you know, like every Friday morning, is when I write my Substack newsletter, and I just enjoy it. It's a time where I'm able to reflect on the week and what I want to share, and I make time for it. And sometimes it can be overwhelming and stressful, and I find ways to sort of try to manage that. Sometimes I'm just writing down all of the things, you know, I literally take a picture, you know, I'm not much of an artist myself, but I'll draw like myself, and then in clouds above me, I'll put all of these things, right? And those clouds can be, you know, things that sort of bring rain or sunshine eventually, right? And so, but seeing it all reminds me that, like, you know, this is a good problem to have, you know, the ability to sort of move from different projects that I really care about that I think make a difference. And trying to have that kind of perspective of just trying to put more good things out into the world for people to react to, it becomes challenges because, like, look, I got a book coming out and there's still a lot of other stuff that I've got going on. And to sort of be able to take a step back and to enjoy it is something that I have to consistently remind myself to do, because otherwise you can caught up in the stress of like, oh, I've got to go do this. And I'm like, you don't have to do anything. You're choosing to do it. And if you're choosing to do it, you know, try to like enjoy it. And that's what I try to do.
So do you want to do a quick breakdown of the three teams that you're coaching? I mean, do we have some winners here, some champions?
Like there's ebbs and flows, right? Players come, players go. It's the Thunder, Lightning, and the Dragons. And for the Dragons, which is they're, you know, U16, so they're all in high school. They're at the age where that team is probably sort of on its last legs as kids sort of go to do their thing. And so that comes with such sadness. I mean, I've seen these girls for like 8 years, coach them, you know, of course, my own daughter, and the idea, I mean, that could end is just, you know, I get emotional thinking about it. Right. I ran into a guy who, he also coached a couple of his kids' teams in the library. And we're not good friends, but I just know of him. And I said, "Hey, are you still coaching?" And he's like, "No." Nah. And I said, "You must have a lot of time on your hands." And he's like, "Yeah." And it was just sort of this sort of like, it was just this sadness. Like, you know, when you're in the thick of it, it can be really stressful and you're dealing with a lot of drama about kids and friendship groups and like, let alone what's happening on the field and how they're progressing. Uh-huh. But then, you know, when you don't have it, you're like, oh my gosh, it's such a privilege to be amongst your daughter and her friends on a field where they're working together.
Yeah.
And to see them grow. I mean, it has been, you know, I wrote, I don't know if you saw this at the time, I wrote at some point where I calculated how much time it is over the course of a week and a year.
Yeah.
And it can seem like just incredible in terms of just like, you know, is that the best use of my time? And it is because it's just wonderful. And I really enjoy it. And the kids are great. And, you know, when they get hurt, I feel for them. And when they do well, I feel for them. And it's wonderful.
So you've been with that team for 8 years. You've seen those girls develop.
Yeah. At least I think it's definitely 8 years. Yeah. And then and then the others for sort of, you know, progressing down a little bit, but all of them for, you know, I think the middle team's probably been like 5-6 years and the younger team 3. And so, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I'm going to check back in with you, Bob. Hopefully many more times, but certainly in 6 years when the youngest of your daughters goes off to college and I'm like, what are you going to do now, Bob? Like what, how do you...
I'm going to be a hot mess is what I'm going to be.
He's going to have plenty of shit to do.
I know he is.
So this is sort of interesting. So not to get too much into my own personal psychology, but you know, I mentioned my mom was a single mom, right? So if she's a single mom, that means that there was no dad. And so being a father is everything to me, you know, and being present for them. And even so much of what I create is probably sort of like a therapy session, you know, waiting to be had. But part of it is like, I'm just always concerned about what am I leaving behind, you know, and making sure that they know me in a way that I did not know my dad and that they can look back and listen to conversations I've had or read things I've written. And even if I may not physically be present, there's all the stuff that they can sort of tap into. And so they are my first, last and important sort of, you know, consumers of anything I'm making.
I think that's the perfect lead in to our three questions, Sean. But we ask three canned questions at the end of these things. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, shoot.
Okay, first question is, what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
You're left-handed.
Wait, this is a big thing. So
come on.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yep. When... So I told you I wanted to be left fielder for the Red Sox, right?
Yeah.
So my mom, God bless her, not much of, you know, a lot of athletic prowess in terms of understanding of sports. And so when it came time to be, to start Little League, she went up and so she knew I was left-handed, but she thought that left-handed meant that's where your glove should go.
Oh, God bless her.
I played the first 2 or 3 years of Little League throwing with the wrong hand. and importantly, batting right-handed. So the one benefit as a lefty you have is to hit lefty,
right?
You know, and I did not have that. And it was, you know, for the grace of God, I brought my glove to a game at Fenway. Back in the day, I didn't know you need tickets to go to a baseball game. We just sort of like went in the fourth inning and sat wherever we thought we could. And so I, on the way back from a game, I left my glove on the tee and I had to borrow a glove. And my brother, who for whatever reason had the proper glove, because he was also left-handed, let me borrow his glove. And next thing you know, I'm throwing, I'm like, man, this is awesome. And so, yes, when I was 10, I wish I would have known what it really meant to be a left-handed baseball player.
Yeah, my son Jack. Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm sure we would be talking about my Hall of Fame baseball career. Right.
We would, for sure. For sure we would. that's probably my favorite answer to that question.
That's
of all
great.
Time.
Yeah.
Second question, Bob, is do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
No, I mean, there's a couple things I've always sort of thought of. I mean, I've always liked Gandhi's be the change you wish to see in the world. I've also liked something that Arthur Ashe has talked about in terms of, you know, his idea of social change, which is start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. Mm. And then the last thing I would have would say is that I was interviewing Sal Khan from Khan Academy years ago.
Oh, I love Sal Khan.
Yeah. And I asked him the question, what he tells social change, you know, whatever, you know, people who are interested in making a difference. And he said, start with one. Like, just start with one person. Like, we talk about scale often and stuff like that. Yeah. But I'm like, if you're just thinking about, like, how am I going to help one person? If the way that I help that one person can be replicated to help another person, that's what I should do. So, sorry, I gave you three instead of one.
That's perfect.
All works.
Didn't you have Dave Eggers on your show one time, too?
I did. Yep.
Another favorite of mine.
Love yeah, he's great.
Okay. God, I wish we had more time, but I know I got to hop. I got one more question for you. And that is, what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
Oof. You know what? I would hope I would hope my children would say he was an awesome dad, first and foremost. And I would hope that everyone else would think that, you know, that they were just grateful that I was around and I made a difference and, you know, and I hope that, I mean, I like that you said wake. I hope they would celebrate. I hope they would just tell a lot of stories. And I've got some that I would not want my children to hear while I was around. But after I'm gone, I'd love for them to hear them. And so I would just love for, you know, just an outpouring and sharing of sort of different stories about things that I did that made them laugh or think or you know, just want to be, you know, a little bit better at something.
Well, we're gonna share all your links and encourage everybody. I encourage everyone to subscribe to your Substack newsletter. It's great. It always has one word as the title, which I don't know. It's weird. I love that for some reason, but it's wonderful. And then we'll link to all the books and just remind everyone to look out for coming on June 4th.
Sounds great.
Yeah, this I can't wait for that book.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks so much. This has been a real pleasure. One other thing I just want to say is, as an aside, one of the things we are trying to do, maybe even your organization is interested in it. We're actually, you know, at the end, it just sounds like a sort of a strange thing. At the end of my children's book, the last thing you'll see is me promoting other children's books. So there's a list of, you know, this idea of a welcome wagon. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the idea of a buddy bench, right? And so here it is, like, what if we had a welcome wagon in as many schools as possible, where there were these books that were all about sort of helping kids find something that makes them feel more belong. And so I'm trying to sort of, you know, raise some funds and work with some partner organizations to get at least 100 of these welcome wagons in schools across the country filled, not with my books, but with books that are from all kinds of authors that are all about kindness and helping kids feel like they belong and fit in.
It's very, very much on brand with your dream team gratitude list.
Yep. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Can we get more information before the book comes out, Bob, on what you're trying to do? Or should we just wait till it comes out?
Yeah. You know, when it comes out, I'm sure I'll share some more information. And then, you know, that'll be great to sort of share and put out there. But
we'll do.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, what a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for reaching it.
Awesome. Yeah, my only disappointment is we didn't get into Brady Belichick conversation, but maybe another time.
We could reboot to do that for sure.
Yeah. Oh, there's
Well, Belichick Kraft. How about that one?
Oh, I know.
Yeah. It was great talking with you. Thanks for reaching out, and hopefully good luck with the book, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for having me on. Thanks for everything you're doing to sort of put some good out in the world as well. It's awesome.
Thanks, Bob. Peace, guys. Take care.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.